Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassam. Recently here in the monastery we have had the novice, the Samanera, Atanyu, preparing for his asking for bhikkhu precepts and taking the next stage of his monastic training, getting his robes made and learning chanting, presumably. And after spending approximately a year as an anagarika, having a look at the monastery, and is this something that I want to take on? Is this something that's going to be helpful? And we get a chance to look at him. Is this somebody we want to have around? And do we think he's up to it? And then taking the initial step of Samanera precepts and as a novice and taking a closer look. And then again, after approximately a year, formally asking to take on the next stage of training, as I said, as a bhikkhu, where definite tightening of the precepts and an increased expectation and requirement and of commitment. And this process of taking on the monastic training is traditionally referred to as going forth from home to homelessness. Obviously, it doesn't have anything to do with sleeping rough on the streets. It's about something else altogether. It's a very important principle encoded in this process of going forth from home to homelessness. And there's a Dhammapada verse 3, 4, 8, which says, let go of the past, let go of the future, and let go of the present. With a heart that is free, cross over to that shore which is free from suffering. Let go of the past, let go of the future, let go of the present. With a heart that is free, cross over to that shore which is free from suffering. And with a heart that is free here is referring to that heart that is free from habits of clinging to the past and clinging to the future. And also, notably, importantly, clinging to the present. There are some who, on the spiritual journey, get the message that getting lost in memories of the past and getting lost to fantasy of the future is not the way. However, they don't get the message that clinging in the present moment is also not the way. So this process of going forth from home to homelessness, this aspiration that Samanera Tanyu has, is to realize this heart that is free from getting lost and clinging to the past, lost and clinging to the future, lost and clinging to the present moment, lost and clinging. And on the level of form, we can see that this tradition that's been around for 2,600 years, this process that the Buddha himself set up in India, where you shave your head, give up your name, give up your money, put on the ochre robe, and take on a specific set of training guidelines. This is joining a spiritual community. And on the level of form, it's obvious that you're giving up the security that most people are cultivating, developing, like money and material security. And as a monk, you don't have money. And you don't own the room that you live in. You depend on food that other people choose to give you. If nobody brings us food here, then it won't be long. We won't be living here. We live here because people bring us food, because people provide this shelter. And so this letting go of material security, letting go of opportunities to cultivate your reputation, which is very much connected to money and possessions, all of these material gestures are letting go on the level of form. However, there's a point to that, and that's letting go on the level of spirit. And it's important that we understand this, because actually this principle of going forth from home to homelessness is not something that just applies to monks and nuns. This principle applies to everybody. It's to do with, where do we find identity? Where are we seeking security? Are we looking for a sense of security in attachments to material objects, like including the body and possessions, and again, as I was saying before, reputation? And the Buddha's realization was that holding firm to any construct, physical, mental, emotional structure, if we cling, upadana, the Pali word, if we hold tight to it, then we contradict reality, because all conditioned phenomena is in a state of change, a state of flux, a state of instability. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the Buddha is telling us to ignore or get rid of or dismiss structures. Quite the opposite, encourages us to be respectful and skillful and sensible and make careful use of structures, wise use of structures, including this structure of the convention of becoming a monk. However, the structure itself is not the point. It's like if you're going shopping in the supermarket and you're buying carrots and fruit and washing powder and soap, and if you don't have a shopping basket or a trolley, that's really rather difficult to carry all that stuff. So you use a trolley, and you're wheeling your trolley out to the car with all your shopping in it, and somebody says, "What'd you buy that trolley for?" I said, "Well, I didn't buy the trolley." I said, "Well, I can see you've got a trolley." And clearly they misperceive the function of the trolley. The trolley is just something you're using. It's a form, it's a structure that's being used for another purpose. And likewise, this form, this structure of becoming a monk, wearing robes, shaving the head, giving up money, is a form, it's a convention, though there's a purpose to it. And it's important that we are able to differentiate between the form and the spirit, or the structure and the purpose. And it does happen, not really, that people make the mistake of thinking the form is the point of it. And so, "I've got to become a monk, otherwise I'm not going to go to heaven when I die." Or, so you become a monk for one day and possibly not even keep the precepts, it's not doing meditation. But because they put the robe on, they're assuming that something special happened. Well, mentally, there may be some gladness at having shown respect to this tradition, and that is not a bad thing. However, again, it's not the point. The form is not the point. It's important we understand this, and not just with regards to going forth from home to homelessness, all aspects of the spiritual life, like bowing. What are we bowing for? What do we bow to the Buddha image? If we really think that the Buddha image is the Buddha, and then somebody steals our Buddha image, what are we going to do? We're going to get really upset. Hopefully nobody steals our Buddha image. However, if they do, that's their problem, that's not our problem. And bowing, what do we bow for? Is it a magic ritual which we think is going to gain us some sort of advantage? Or is there another point to bowing? Well, hopefully all of us appreciate that the point of bowing is this lowering ourselves in front of that which symbolizes the spirit of the Buddha image, is it symbolizes perfect selfless wisdom and compassion. It reminds us of this possibility, selfless wisdom, selfless compassion. And we lower ourselves in front of it because the opposite stance of which is, "I don't know, I didn't need anybody," push our chest out and turn our head back and "I can handle myself." That arrogant, conceited stance, which we, probably all to some degree, unfortunately, familiar with. That's the opposite of the humble surrendering of my way to, out of faith for the Buddha's way, out of faith, respect, confidence in the Dhamma. So this bowing, a form, yes, we lower ourselves. However, it's not surrendering responsibility. In fact, it's taking responsibility. It's skillfully using this form to address the unfortunate habit of self-centeredness. Not so long ago, I mentioned the example from the scriptures of this monk, Wakali, who made a big mistake in his relationship with the Buddha. Apparently, the Buddha was stunningly good-looking, and Wakali was so impressed that he used to just sit around and gaze at the Buddha and delight at viewing the Buddha, and until the Buddha decided, well, that's enough of that, and gave him a stern talking to and sent him away. And in the process, pointed out, said, you're looking at the wrong thing, Wakali. You're looking at the form of the Buddha. If you want to see the Buddha, then you see the Dhamma. The Dhamma is actuality, truth. You study the Dhamma, you practice the Dhamma. If you want to see the Buddha, if you want to be close to the Buddha, then you study, you practice the Dhamma. So this basic principle is important, not just with regards to Buddhism and any spiritual practice. There's always the risk that we project too much out onto the form. Like, is my sitting meditation posture accurate enough? I can't sit on the floor in perfect lotus, and so I can't meditate. Well, don't believe that. If you've grown up sitting on the floor and you're comfortable sitting in perfect lotus, then yes, your breathing might be helped and your body posture might be helped. However, if you can't sit in perfect lotus, then sit as well as you can. Sitting on the floor, is it helpful, potentially? Though if you can't sit on the floor, then you sit in a chair and make do with what you've got. Or studying, like sometimes Buddhism is presented in such a complicated way, and you start to read the books, and some, if you read the wrong books, you can get really confused. And somebody told me recently that they chose not to listen to Dhamma talks because they thought they might be so arcane and irrelevant that they're just making more confused. Well, it's true that sometimes the form, the structure in which the Dhamma is presented can cause people to feel inadequate, though that wasn't the Buddha's intention. The Buddha wanted us to feel confident in our aspiration to realize the cause of suffering and freedom from suffering. He really wanted to learn that there is a training, there's something we can do about our hearts and our minds and our bodies so that we can align ourselves with true principles and live our life in a way whereby we're learning from what we experience, learning from the joy and learning from the sorrow, learning from the pleasure and learning from the pain, learning from the praise and learning from the criticism, learning from all of life, whatever happens to us. What matters, surely, is, are we learning? Are wisdom and compassion growing, or are they waning? So if we again mistake the form and think we've got to understand all these books and all these complex concepts that are sometimes used to present the Buddha's teachings, well, that's missing the point. We find books, we find teachers, we find teachings that speak to us where we're at about our condition, and then we're aligning ourselves with the spirit of the teachings, the spirit of the Dhamma. This very educated fellow came to see Ajahn Chah, a politician who had been through a very difficult and tragically sad situation, and he was advised to go and see this great meditation master in the forest, Ajahn Chah, and ask for some Dhamma teachings to help him with his suffering. And he went to see Ajahn Chah, and he asked Ajahn Chah, what is the middle way? And Ajahn Chah could have given him an analysis of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. Samma ditti, samma sankappa, samma vajja, samma kammata, samma ajiva, samma vayamadi, samma sati, samma samadhi. Right view, right aspiration or right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right collectedness, and could have explained how these teachings, what they mean in detail, and sammāditti, they could have contemplate the Four Noble Truths and contemplate that which is wholesome and that which is unwholesome and so on, and go through an explanation of right aspiration or right thought and what does this mean and go into great details. However, what he did give was a very simple teaching, a very practical teaching, and said that there's two extremes and there's the middle way. One extreme is liking and the other extreme is disliking. And the middle way is knowing liking, knowing disliking. Now that doesn't contradict sammāditti, sammāsankappa and so on. It doesn't contradict the precise form of the teachings that the Buddha gave us. However, it's perhaps more applicable, and in this case of this person, somebody's human, was suffering. He was lost in pain. And the teachings, or the encouragement we have in terms of the spirit of Dhamma, is to use our faculties to see where, when, and how we create problems out of the pain of life. Everybody experiences pain. Some people, that is the awakened beings, they don't experience suffering. They experience pain, though they don't experience suffering. What's the difference? Well, what the Buddha was pointing out, and what Ajahn Chah was pointing out, is whether you get lost in pain and lost in disliking. Why do you get lost in disliking? Do you get lost in pain? Because we get lost in liking, we get lost in pleasure. The middle way is that perspective, that quality of attention that can observe the mind tending in this direction or tending in that direction. That watchfulness, that alertness. And that's something that's quite different. That's pointing to the spirit of the training. Sometimes it's the case that the scholars who emphasize the forms of the Buddha's teachings get a little upset with meditation monks and even criticize meditation monks because of that slightly creative approach to interpreting the teachings that Ajahn Chah was giving an example of there. So you can focus on the form, which has its place, but that's not the point. The form, again, like the supermarket trolley, or like shaking somebody's hand. Why do you shake somebody's hand? It's not because you can't stand up on your own. I mean, as a child, you need to hold hands with somebody to stand up. As an adult, we don't need to hold somebody's hand, you know, to stand up. You shake your hand as a gesture of harmlessness. You know? So welcome. The origin of that symbolic gesture, as you may know, is that it's the hand that used to hold the dagger which you could stick somebody with. And instead of doing that, you put out your dagger hand and you shake hands and you enable a friendly meeting and following that, hopefully a friendly conversation. So there's the form and there's the spirit and this principle and with regards of going forth from home to homelessness on the level of form, yes, becoming a monk or becoming a nun, as the case may be, on the level of form. But the spirit is what is letting go of the effort to find security in clinging to materiality, clinging to forms, clinging to structures, clinging to thoughts and feelings and emotions. And finding identity as selfless, open-hearted awareness. That's homelessness, from home to homelessness. The traditional home is an abiding that we think is secure, a building, a structure, until a fire comes along or a flood comes along or we can't afford to pay the rent anymore, whatever happens, and we lose our home. That's not a secure home. So the Buddha's encouragement to move from home to homelessness is really about where do we find security? Where do we find identity? Do we find identity in clinging to forms and structures? Or do we find identity in letting go of the past, letting go of the future, letting go of the present, with a heart that is free from all habits of clinging, cross over to that other shore that is free from suffering? That is the state of finding identity as selfless, open-hearted awareness. And this is not just some abstract theory that we may or may not find interesting. It's something you can apply in daily life. Often the question arises about preferences. Do we have to let go of all of our preferences to become awakened? Well, again, to quote Ajahn Chah in this area, he used to have this expression of talking about the way we have things. He'd say, have, don't have. Or make having the same as not having. Now, from a purely conceptual perspective, that doesn't make sense. I mean, there's having and there's not having. They're completely different. As far as Ajahn Chah was concerned, he was saying, make having the same as not having. What does he mean by that? Well, in the example of, for instance, having a preference for manuka honey and peanut butter on brown bread toast in the morning, or having rice porridge with onions and chili sauce. Now, I'm pretty certain if Ajahn Chah was to visit Harnham and we put both in front of him, he would eat the rice soup with onions and chili sauce in it, and garlic probably. He'd sprinkle dried garlic on it, probably. His body is conditioned to prefer that because that's what he grew up with. He'd probably leave the toast with manuka honey and organic tahini and just leave it to one side and not touch it. If, however, all we gave him was the toast with tahini and honey on it, do we think he would suffer? That's the difference. For an awakened being, they have preferences because the body is conditioned by preference. The body is conditioned by that which it's familiar with. However, because there's right understanding of liking and disliking, the mind is not lost in liking, not lost in disliking. There's the knowing, and that knowing is the freedom. Again, Ajahn Chah talking about in his old age, as his mind was going, he had a stroke or a series of strokes, and he would say that he could see it happening. He'd say how, I know what I want to say is, Sumedho, come here, and I open my mouth, and what comes out is, Prabhakara, come here. And I can't stop it. I know that's what's happening, and it's okay. Well, I'm not exactly sure what he said about it. That was the point he was. That's the principle he was pointing to. It's the knowing. That's the freedom. That's the spirit. That's the point. Finding identity in the conventional functioning of the brain or the body means that we're going to suffer when they deteriorate. Finding identity in selfless, open-hearted awareness means there's a possibility of being free from suffering. So that's the goal, that's the aspiration. And the example of having, though not having, you can also apply this to everyday, like emotions. You have emotional reactions. You know, something beautiful, I mean, delightful happens. You witness something very beautiful happening and joy arises. Do we have the joy in a way whereby we become intoxicated by it and lost in it? Or can there be the experience of feeling joy? Maybe there's even tears of joy. Can there be the knowing that there's joy and not get lost in it? That's the question worth considering. And likewise with the sorrow, with the sadness. Can there be the perception of loss if you lose something that you valued? Can there be sadness? Can there be sadness without being lost in the sadness? That's having without having. So it's quite possible to be emotionally sensitive and emotionally alive without being emotionally literate. Some people might assume that they're emotionally literate because they're emotionally sensitive. To be emotionally literate, we need to apply these principles of training and investigate to see our relationship. How do we actually respond with liking and disliking? Remember, we're not trying to get rid of liking and disliking, not trying to get rid of pleasure and pain. So long as we're conscious and living as human beings, there will be experiences of pleasure and pain, unless you're somebody who has some superior access to an elevated state of samadhi, temporarily free from that. For the rest of the time, there will be experiences of pleasure and pain. The work is to develop our potentials, our faculties, so as to feel what we feel, see what we feel, sense what we sense, without becoming lost in it. So this commitment that Samanera Tanya is making to taking up the training as a bhikkhu, and the aspiration is to realize the heart that is free from all clinging, clinging to the past, clinging to the future, and clinging to the present. Though not everybody can do this, not everybody wants to do it in this form, hopefully we can all see the principle applies to everybody. Thank you for your attention.